Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Pure Dog Talk is proud to be sponsored by Trupanion. The holidays can be a stressful time, right? So one thing you shouldn't have to stress out about is what would happen if your pet gets sick or injured. The Trupanion policy covers unexpected veterinary costs, helping to ease the financial burden for pet owners. This time of year, that's a big deal, right? Last year, the Trupanion policy paid 115,000 claims during the holiday season, totaling over $24 million. Trupanion has a special program just for breeders to send their litters home with a special offer to try out the insurance. And along with this special offer, Trupanion's breeder support team will send you starter kits with helpful information for your buyers. Join thousands of breeders, me included, having peace of mind knowing your litters are going home protected this holiday season. Sign up with Trupanion for free through my partner page today. And don't forget, let them know Pure Dog Talk sent you. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I am your host, Laura Reeves, and we are back with Dr. Marty Greer. And we have a good topic, I think, for all of us to chew on, if you will, as we start the new decade and the new year and look at some of the legislative issues that are being raised around the country. Marty's going to put on her hat as a National Animal Interest Alliance board member, and we're going to talk about some of this legislation that is particularly and specifically targeted at veterinary medical decisions for your pet and the government telling you what you can and cannot do, which of course makes us all crazy and our heads spin off our bodies, right?
So...
So, Marty, let's take some of these that we're seeing. For example, New York State has a couple, one on bark softening and one actually on crop and dock. Crop and dock is finally coming to the United States. We've been waiting for it for years. It's been enacted in Canada, obviously around the world. So it's a bulwark here. What do we do? Why do we not want to encourage this legislation medically?
And well, medically and logistically. And
yes.
From a logistical perspective, as soon as they start dictating to us what veterinary care we need and need not do, we have a whole nother set of circumstances here that are going to become a slippery slope, and we're going to be very unhappy about it. Once they start saying to us, you cannot do an ear crop, you cannot do a tail dock, you cannot do a bark softening, you cannot do a declaw, you must do a spay. Then we get into, you must do a dental cleaning. You must provide this level of care for your pet. You must take off this lump. And if that means that you have to give up your child's car seat, your child's medical care because you can't afford both, then you have now had all of your rights taken away as a pet owner. So it's going to start to become an issue that if those things are mandated, we're going to have clients that stop coming seeking veterinary care if they are dictated what kind of care they can and cannot have. And that scares me a lot.
Right. And, you know, we were talking a little bit off air. We know that at some level, some of the veterinary associations are coming out in support of these legislative issues. Can we talk a little bit about why and how we can perhaps have some influence on their opinions?
Yeah, and I think we do need to influence their opinions. They're hearing it from being students, from kind of a brainwashing perspective.
Mm-hmm.
They're hearing their professors. They're hearing the Humane Society of the U.S. We're hearing the Humane Society of Veterinarians. I'm making these kinds of stands, and it becomes problematic. So I think we need to start saying that this is a decision made between a veterinarian and the client, and they have to recognize that while the veterinarians are involved, we have the ability to provide pre-op blood work, appropriate anesthesia, good post-op pain management. You know, we're really taking good care of these patients. And some of these procedures, ultimately, if they're lost, they're going to start falling into the hands of the lay people who do these. And I'll tell you honestly, I have seen ear crops done. I have seen a lot of lay people doing procedures that really they're not qualified to do. We don't have appropriate pain management. We don't have appropriate anesthesia. It's a really scary and really slippery slope. They're using anesthetics that they shouldn't be using. Some of them are using them without DEA intervention. So it becomes a big concern to me that once veterinarians lose this, it's like the equine dentistry. It's like foot trimming in cows. We lost a lot of those things, and now it's lay people doing it and not necessarily doing it with the medical background that they should have to provide medical care.
That piece is terrifying, right? I mean,
yes.
We're supposed to be moving forward in society, not backwards.
Right.
I mean, I'll just use tail docking because it's a procedure with which I'm familiar. You know, certainly in the 1800s when these tails were docked, the guy was taking it out and whacking it off with a hatchet on the stump. Right? I mean, legit, that's how it was done, in my knowledge, to the last century by some people in this country. And so our goal would be to improve the quality of care, not reduce it. Yes?
Right, right. And when I see procedures done on kitchen tables with a light overhead and no one running anesthesia, no one checking blood work ahead of time, no one doing EKGs prior to anesthesia, that's a giant step backwards that we've taken in veterinary medicine, because veterinarians have been forced or at least coerced into believing that it's not an ethical thing for them to be doing. So it's still happening. Ear crops are still being done. Debarkings are still being done. And declaws are going to happen too. So it's a really unfortunate set of circumstances if we do take this giant step backwards.
Right. So let's talk also, I think, again, we were talking off air, the sort of, if you will, hypocrisy of let's not do these relatively simple, safe veterinary procedures with antibiotics and pain management and all of that, but let's go rip out your dog's internal organs because that's better.
Right. And so coming full circle, we can talk about the more invasive procedures. Neutering is somewhat invasive. Spaying is definitely invasive. It doesn't matter if you're a dog or a cat. It's a very invasive procedure. It's an abdominal procedure. And it's one that women would be put in the hospital for at least a 24-hour period and takes full anesthesia. And it's a full abdominal procedure. And we are doing that as if it is a minor procedure. And it's not. It's being done by humane societies and other high-volume places in large numbers with patients not receiving the level of care, even though they're telling you it's high quality, high volume. That's like believing that you can get Ritz Hotel service at a Motel 6 price, and it just doesn't work that way. So our patients are being spayed and neutered when they're too young. They're being spayed,
yes,
and neutered as a matter of course. It's become the norm since the 1970s for us in the United States to think that everything should be spayed or neutered. And the increasing number of articles are being published and documentation that's being developed showing that we see health risks associated with these young spay and neuters. I think we really need to be paying attention to that. The primary reason that we spay and neuter dogs in the United States is because we are either unable or too lazy to manage our dog and cat's sexual behaviors. They don't do them in Europe, and if we want to pretend that we want to be like the Europeans and not do tails and ears, then we also need to look at what their thoughts are for spaying and neutering, and they consider these to be mutilation procedures.
Mm.
So unless the dog has a pyometra, unless the dog has an ovarian tumor, unless the dog has testicular tumors, there really isn't a reason for us medically to be spaying and neutering our pets. So I have a huge pushback on this, and I work in a practice where many, in fact, most of our patients are not spayed or neutered because we do canine reproduction.
Right.
And feline reproduction. And I've seen for years the things that they've been talking about. So for 38 years I've done this, and it's not a surprise to me to say, yes, we see less cancer of the bones. We see less cancer of the spleen. Yes, we see less thyroid disease and less urinary incontinence and less obesity and less thyroid disease if our pets are left intact rather than spayed or neutered. A lot of veterinarians are struggling with this information because it's so contrary to what they've been taught in veterinary school and been told by the public. And really, spaying and neutering serves one purpose, and that's population control in the United States. And they don't do it in the European countries, and they have good population control, and they don't have these kinds of issues.
And we think the reason for the lack of population control issues in Europe is?
Because they know how to manage their pet's behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the doggy daycares that we have here that are just everywhere, and everybody thinks that's the cool, trendy thing to do. They won't take dogs that are intact because they don't know how to put them in groups of dogs that are safe to be together when they're in heat, when they're not in heat, when they're the kind of groups that can be appropriate for play groups. So we have clients that are being forced into doing spays and neuters for political reasons. They go to Thanksgiving dinner and their family says, what? You didn't spay your dog? Mm-hmm. So they feel pressured. They feel pressured by the humane societies and they feel pressured by the media. So it's really difficult for people to understand that there are a lot of benefits to leaving our pets intact. And I don't want to get completely off on this subject except to compare it to the fact that this is an invasive procedure that's elective. As in almost every case, it's elective, and then we're telling people that they can't have an elective procedure that will keep their dog in their neighborhood because the dog barks so loudly that the neighbors can't live with it. The owner is then forced to make a decision on, do I keep the dog or do I eliminate the dog from my household? And in reality, the bark softening procedure is a very simple procedure. It's done very briefly under anesthesia. It takes about 2 minutes under anesthesia. It's a longer time for them to get an EKG than it is to have the procedure done. We take a very small piece of tissue, about a 4-millimeter section of tissue out of each vocal fold surgically. The patients are under full anesthesia. They have an EKG before surgery. They may have blood work before surgery. They're awakened by a technician, and they're sent home with pain management. And these dogs continue to get to have the same fun behavior because barking is recreational, and dogs sometimes like to do it, just like we like to talk.
Yeah.
So they continue the same behavior. We haven't altered their psyche. We've just softened the noise that comes out of them. So now we have a pet that can stay in a household in a neighborhood where otherwise this dog would be eliminated.
And the other thing about bark softening particularly, there's almost zero side effects that I'm aware of, right?
Right. Every now and then we'll have one that has a little scar tissue that develops and they have a little bit of respiratory distress, but done well, nearly every dog makes a completely normal recovery and they can go on to have a very nice, happy, enjoyable, and softer life.
Right, softer, quieter.
Yeah, softer, much quieter.
And, you know, I think we can do this for all of the procedures that government officials who are receiving only half of the information that's available are making for us, which, as I said, the head spinning off part.
Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute.
Heads up, crew. Join our patrons today. Get immediate access to the support of a closed Facebook chat group, special patrons only episodes, free mentoring sessions, and more. Just like the NPR of dogdom, Pure Dog Talk brings you the news, the knowledge, and the insight to succeed with your purebred dog. In exchange, our Pure Dog patrons share the love with monthly or annual gifts, and that helps defray the cost of overhead and sort of keeping the MP3s rolling, you know? Hit me up, Laura at puredogtalk.com, and I'll hook you up with the details. So let's give out some real actual information about some of these other procedures. Declaws. Now, not all of us here as listeners have cats, but we all, this is a stand together or fall apart, right? So
exactly. So we really have to be all on the same page and we can't be selective about what procedures we're going to have dictated and which ones we can't. But declaws, I still think declaws have a wonderful place in the homes of a lot of people. I've had clients come in that have AIDS, HIV, cancer, they're otherwise immunosuppressed, elderly, and without having a cat declawed, many of these people can't have this cat as their pet. I have one woman who came in and her two kittens were running up her nightgown every morning, and she found that to be unsafe for her health, for her skin's health, so she requested declaws on them. I've had many clients that have been elderly and without a declaw and the cat would scratch them or someone else that's immunocompromised. A cat scratch can be a serious health concern. It can cause, actually, there is a disease called cat scratch fever.
Yes.
It's not just a song.
Exactly.
It can lead to any kind of infection. It can lead to the inability to keep these patients, these cats as pets. And again, we get back to the same thing as pre-op, they get an EKG, they have blood work, they have a complete physical exam, they're under full anesthesia. We now use laser for our procedures and post-op pain medication. And the way that kittens and cats wake up now from surgery after their declaws, These cats are now sitting in their cage overnight because we do keep them over just to make sure that there's not any tracking of any blood around the house. We don't even have to bandage them with the laser and the surgical glue that we use. But those cats are sticking their feet out of the cages the night of surgery, like within 4 hours of surgery, and patting my technicians on the top of the head because they want to get some attention. So clearly their feet can't hurt too badly if they're sitting forward and bopping people on the head with the very foot that they just had surgery on. And it makes a huge difference. It's not just about your furniture. It's not just about your stereo speakers or your curtains. It's really about your own personal health and your ability to keep pets in a lifestyle that otherwise you may be restricted on because your doctor may simply say, I'm sorry, a cat in your life is dangerous and we just can't have that happening. So I really think that it's time for us to sit up and pay notice to what's going on around us and realize what's happening.
And before we move on to a couple of the other procedures, I think it's important to tie in the information that's coming, like from HABRI, the Human-Animal Bond Research Institute, that talks about the importance of animals in our lives and how they literally extend our lives. So all of the things that we can do to enable people to keep pets with them is of benefit to the human condition.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there's definitely research, and everyone is probably aware of the quality of life changes, the kind of activity that people are kind of forced into maintaining. When the dog gets you up in the morning and drags you out for a walk, it's much healthier for you than if you sit home and eat a big donut instead. So our pets do serve a lot of value. They serve as social lubricants. So if we're out walking our dog, we're having interactions with other people, with our pets. You know, there's so many health benefits that we have been taught to see. And then for us to say, we're going to restrict some of these procedures so you no longer can have this pet, it flies in the face of common sense.
Right, exactly. And moving on to some of the other procedures, tail docks.
Right.
I think it's fascinating. You and I both come from docked breeds that were docked for a specific reason. There's the whole preservation breeding piece. But I also think it's quite fascinating using the case study in Scotland, where the government demanded that dogs no longer be docked. And the data, the research that came back from those dogs that were working dogs that were no longer docked, made them change that law.
Right. And there's definitely benefits to it. I've had a number of dogs that have come into the practice that have cracked their tails open, and they're very difficult to get to heal. And sometimes then as adult dogs, we're doing a major procedure on them. Because taking the tail off of an adult dog is kind of a big deal. Taking it off of a 3 to 5 day old puppy is a very quick procedure. And again, we use local anesthesia. We don't do this without managing their pain. In our practice, we use Karo syrup ahead of the procedure because there was a study done in pigs that showed that if they had a higher glucose, their cortisol levels were lowered, indicating that their stress levels were lower when they had some of these procedures done. So all of our puppies will end up with a local block and with Karo syrup, and then right back on mom to nurse. So we're very attentive to the fact that we need to be careful that we minimize their stress. I don't do their tails until they're gaining weight because I want to make sure that they're off to a good start and we don't diminish their ability to nurse or anything else by doing the tails. And again, if it's done in a veterinary office, we have sterile instruments, we have appropriate suture, we have appropriate scrubs and preps for our procedures. So we wear sterile gloves, so it's not the kind of barbaric procedure that used to be done out on the farm.
It was actually one of my mentors and wire hair pointers that described to me how she did tails, and I was just, even I was bug-eyed. I'm like, yeah, no, that's not how that's going to go. You know, I mean, it's very old school, but I don't know that people out there in the world, you know, regular people, I don't know that they understand that that's not how it's done.
Right. And Mike Rowe of Dirty Jobs did a tremendous piece, if you ever have a chance to find it, that compared doing, I think it was a castration on a sheep versus banding the sheep. And the comparison, and the sheep that had bands put on the scrotum for removing the testicles limped away and looked pretty pathetic, and the lamb that had the testicles cut leaped out of their arms and it went sprinting across the pasture as if nothing had ever happened to it. So it is kind of an interesting look at livestock as well. And I think that we have to realize that this is also going to impact our livestock industries. And there are reasons in that industry that we do tails. You know, we do tails in lambs to keep them from ending up with fly strike, which is maggots around the rectum.
Right.
A really disturbing and dangerous and can be a life-threatening disorder. our tails are docked in our dogs for a reason. So it's not just recreational. It's not just that it's breed type, or it's not just how we want them to look. There is actually a functional reason to do these procedures.
Much more functional reason to do a tail dock than to do a spay, for example?
Exactly, because there is no functional reason to do a spay. It's purely for our convenience, so that we don't have to mess around with managing our pet's sexual behaviors.
Exactly. And, you know, it's interesting, and you and I had this conversation, and I think it's fair to acknowledge that what we're less familiar with, we're less sure about, right?
Oh, yeah.
But when I was talking to people about ear crops, because that's not something I have in my breeds, and trying to understand the process and the procedure and what was important and why it was important, they made a comment to me that I thought was really interesting. Dogs in the wild, right? Like wolves, coyotes, jackals, dingoes, go figure, all have erect ears. That is
right.
The natural state of the canid, if you will.
Right, right. And if you look at the 30-pound quintessential street dog that you see in many of the third world countries around the world, it's a 30-pound short-coated brown dog with a curled tail and an upright ear.
Yep.
And eventually all dogs end up going back to that kind of appearance if they're not kept as purebred dogs. So yeah, an erect ear has a function. It allows them to hear better. It reduces ear infections. It cuts down on the number of ear injuries that they have during the kinds of hunting behaviors that they have to hunt for their food or compete with one another. So there's absolutely reasons for them to have an erect ear.
Absolutely. And I've watched enough Doberman ear postings now and Manchester's and a few other breeds.
Yeah.
It is amazing to me. Those ears are not sensitive at all. I mean, I was surprised. Okay. Like, I'm going to admit it. This was when I was like, okay. And being around it, you come to understand this is not, I mean, the dogs are not fazed by it.
No, they cruise right through it. And it really is a thing that we have to look at is we've bred dogs in the breeds that have crops to have a certain type of ear set so that they're easier to get to stand.
Mm-hmm.
And if you stop doing ear crops, you get things that look like the flying nun for ears on your schnauzers.
Yes.
So they no longer hang down. They now stick out to the sides and then hang down and they look very bizarre. So it's not just breed type. It's not just appearance that we're looking at. There's absolutely reasons that we do these procedures.
And I do want to focus on breed type and appearance because we are preservation breeders. So I believe, my opinion, speak to me on this, we as breeders and members of society should have the opportunity to own the dog that looks and functions the best as the fit for our family.
Yes, I agree. We have dogs that are going to live with us for 15 years. And when I go to buy a car, I don't go blindfolded. I get to go and pick out the style, the size, the color, the shape, the speed, all the things that I want my car to be for me. And I think we should be able to do the same with our dogs. When you go to the shelter and end up having to get whatever happens to be there, you don't know what it's going to turn out to be. I had a client that wanted a small breed dog to replace a fairly good-sized Labrador that she'd had in the past. And I picked it out for her at a training session for procedures that we did down at the veterinary school. Mm. And he was just this adorable little dog, and I figured he'd be about 40 pounds when he grew up, and he turned out to be 140.
Oh, dear
so
God.
It didn't exactly meet her needs. So
and you're a trained professional, dude.
Yeah, I know. Thought I knew what I was doing. So, you know, we have to look at the size, the coat character, the activity level, their indoor activity versus their outdoor activity, how social they are with other people and other dogs. And those are all things that are predictable based on breed and based on family heritage. And it allows people to be much more accurate in their selection. And if dogs end up not meeting our needs, they end up going back to the shelter or end up being euthanized. And really, those are very difficult things to have to do. And the same thing with the dogs that bark too much and the same thing with the cats that scratch too much. They end up back at the shelter. And many times, they never find an appropriate forever home because their behaviors are such that people can't live with them. You know, I really think it's unfair for us to not allow people to select what they want. In the United States, our ancestors came here because we wanted freedom to make these decisions ourselves. The Europeans stayed behind because they were a little less demanding. But our heritage in the U.S. is a whole bunch of people who were pretty determined to get their way. And that's who we still are today. We're Americans. We're different than the rest of the world. And I think we need to recognize that freedom, that we're going to lose a lot of this if we start to kowtow. And the legislation is happening. They'll start off with something like, no tail docking in cows in New Jersey. Well, how many cows are in New Jersey that this is going to affect? But the humane societies and the legislative people, sources that want to put legislation through, know that in states without a lot of agriculture, they can get these bills passed.
Right.
And then they move to the next state and the next state and the next state. And pretty soon, then they're encroaching on things that are happening in the Midwest, where we have our livestock industry. So as soon as we start down this slippery slope, we lose every freedom that we have. So I really want people to stand up and participate in legislative bills that pertain to livestock, that pertain to things that don't necessarily just influence them directly, because it's going to be the spillover, it's going to be the slippery slope that what happens next and the unintended consequences of the legislation that gets passed for one thing is going to end up passed on to the next.
And you're absolutely right. And we're seeing it in New York State as we speak.
Yes.
So listeners, your legislative job, January 1, as soon as you all get back to work, start calling up your local representative, your state senator, your state representative, whoever it is, and help them understand. Use some of these talking points. Use some of this information. Help them understand in a rational, a logical, and unemotional, no screaming and calling of names way why this is important.
Right. Let them know who you are. Get to know them before there's a bill in front of them so that they know that you're someone that's trustworthy, that's logical, that has science behind what you're talking about. Go to the NAIA website. They're going to have a lot of great talking points for you. We just had this at our meeting 2 days ago, so we're going to be expanding on what's there. We're going to put up a video of what it looks like to do a debark because I want people to actually see the size of the piece of tissue that comes out, how long the procedure takes, how uninvasive it is. It's just through the oral cavity. There's no other incision made. I want people to witness this firsthand. When I have veterinary students here, I show them these procedures that a 4-millimeter piece of tissue is snipped out of the vocal fold. It is not done with putting a pipe down their throat the way that people are going to tell you. But we don't want to go back to the same kinds of things that happened when abortions happened on back streets because women
right.
couldn't get them legally. So, you know, we start to have to realize that if we can do these procedures medically in an appropriate setting with appropriate medical care, it's much safer for everyone involved, for the owner, for the pet, for the veterinarian, for everyone. And I don't want veterinarians to be bamboozled into not being able to do procedures that are medically appropriate for their patients.
Absolutely. Perfect. Okay, Marty, thank you so much. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. And I very much look forward to continuing to visit with you on the Veterinary Voice next year.
Sounds great. Thank you for having me.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.